and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, Doug Vandegraaff gives a preview of his new book, A Guide to the Notorious Bars of Alaska. The book takes readers on a tour of more than 100 charismatic Alaska drinking establishments. Many have been around since the end of Prohibition in 1933. This talk was recorded at the UAA bookstore on September 26th. It's been edited for broadcast. Let's get going. Doug Vandegraaff is introduced here by Alaska historian Joe Antonsen.
Thank you. I wear many hats, and I love this place, and I am the state historian for Alaska. It's a pleasure for me to say a couple of words to introduce Doug, but I also want to talk about his editor, who's standing there giving me a glaring look with the camera in her hand, Lael Morgan, because both of them left Alaska. Lael keeps coming back. I have this habit of showing up, inviting myself to visit her at her house the day she puts it up for sale to move back to Alaska. And that's happened, really, at least twice. Doug, too, tried to leave Alaska after being here. And although he has not yet come back except to visit, he has spent a lot of his vacation time and come here to research and continue his work. And I think there's a part of him that still belongs here. Lael has always urged me to leave Alaska, and I can't. Every day around here since I moved in 1975 has been interesting and fascinating, and it's still the greatest place. And she's back, and hopefully to stay. And her story is she's also bought her cemetery plot up in the Birch Hill Cemetery already. But Doug, I know Doug also because he is a cartographer with the federal government, worked here and then went back to Washington, D.C., and was with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and now he's with BOEMS, and I wrote it down but forgot my notes for what that all stands for, but they used to be Minerals Management Service. And he's the chief cartographer, but he also serves for the agency on the U.S. Board on Geographic Names, and the commission that I serve as staff to is the State Geographic Names Review Board, and so I've worked with Doug with Geographic Names, and it's always been made me pleased that when we send our proposals to the U.S. Board for consideration for approving names to be on federal maps, that he knows a lot about Alaska and either can hopefully speak to some of the creative names or various names that come before the board to be named, to be placed on the U.S. topographic maps. And right now, he's even the chair. And it was a pleasure to watch him last spring keep the unruly bunch in order and also be one that people frequently went to for questions and also went to for recommendations for restaurants. So it's no surprise that he has written the book that he has written, since he's very good at the whole social end of conferences and meetings. And then when I read a couple of his chapters of his book that he shared with me, he writes well. So I'm sure that he will also speak well, because he gives you background information, has a great story, and a good twist. So Doug, please entertain us.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. I flew in yesterday from D.C., and I've been smiling ever since. I can't take the smile off my face. Very, very, very happy to be here. And I remember going to Joe in 1999 when I first thought of this idea of writing this book and asking her, do you know of any other books about bars in Alaska? And she says, actually, no, I don't. You know, so no one's ever written a book about bars in Alaska? She says, no, I don't think so. And I, well, there we go. I'm going to do this. And the very next year, I got promoted, and I had to move to D.C., and I thought to myself, how am I going to do this book? And I realized when I got to D.C., I was set on assignment to go to the Library of Congress. I was looking at territorial records, and I just realized, I go, look at all the Alaska records. And then I went to the National Archives and discovered the same thing. So this is what I'm going to talk about today. I'll talk about the guidebook, but I'm going to talk about what makes a bar notorious and the criteria that I chose to include the bars in my book. Talk about my search of Alaska's oldest bars. I will give you a short history of alcohol and bars in Alaska. I'm going to talk about the most famous bars in Alaska. I'm going to stop there, and if you guys still want me to keep talking, I will talk about the notorious bars of Seward.
Well, we definitely want to hear about those.
Is that right? Well, okay. We'll see. 15 minutes from now, if you want, we still want me to keep talking, I'll do that. All right. So, as I started to say a few minutes ago, I moved to Alaska in 1983. I was living in Flagstaff, Arizona, and I just graduated from Northern Arizona University, and the Bureau of Land Management hired me as a cartographer. And I had never been to Alaska and never been to Anchorage, and I was in awe of the scenery and of the city that would be my home for the next 17 years. I was 24, and going to a bar was still a novelty to me. I was blown away by the bars of Anchorage, Alaska, compared to Arizona. You know, you would walk into a bar and there'd be things like dime beer, or you could buy a six-pack, which is six drinks at a time. And the bars stayed open until 5 o'clock in the morning. It opened up again at six. Again, I felt like I had moved to the 20th century version of the Wild, Wild West. Crazy 80s didn't last for long. But as I grew older, I would travel to the lower 48, and I would visit bars in the lower 48, and I began to realize the uniqueness of Alaska's bars. For instance, the Birdhouse on Turnagain Arm. I had never been in a bar where the entire bar itself was permanently on a slant, and all the bras and panties and business cards. And the smell. Do you remember the smell of that place? You know, I had never seen a bar like that. There are other Salty Dog bars in the lower 48, but none like the location at the end of the Homer Spit of the Salty Dog Saloon. I was sent to Unalaska Dutch Harbor for work assignments, and I had fishermen had told me, when you're there, you got to go to this bar called the Elbow Room. You'll never forget it. So I couldn't wait to go to the Elbow Room. Other fishermen told me, if you're ever down in Pelican, there's this bar called Rosie's. You got to go to Rosie's. And I heard all these crazy stories about Rosie's. What a thrill it was to go to Pelican and interview Rosie Miller. I really enjoyed that. As I started to say, I moved to D.C. in 2000 and started doing my formal research. And I documented the history and notoriety of 135 bars that met the criteria. What makes a bar notorious? Bars are usually the scene of where people go to have a good time. You know, they're celebrating a wedding anniversary, a birthday, of course. They're doing a bachelor party, a bachelor party, a bar mitzvah, or whatever. People are usually having a good time at bars. They're playing games. They're listening to music. Unfortunately, bars can also be the scene of tragedy, even murder. And that's happened in bars in Alaska. Not all of them, of course. But I think that whether you're having a good time or you witness something absolutely awful at a bar, you're going to remember that, and you're going to associate that particular instance with that bar. And I think that as time goes on and the years go by, your memory crowds and it makes the facts get distorted, but because you have associated that event with the bar, it kind of cements your mind, and you associate the events with the bar, and it becomes notorious. And I think that bars that have been around for 25 years or more happen to be, or almost always, are notorious. To some people, maybe not everyone that knows about it, that knows about the bar, but I think that at least a bar that's been in the same location, the same name for 25 years is probably notorious. So that's the criteria. It's only three things. Bar must be in continuous operation for at least 25 years, just like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Bar must remain located in the same city, town, or village. And the name of the bar must remain the same, or if it changed names, people still call it by that old name. I was very interested in which bars are the absolutely oldest. And so when I first started this project, I was kind of focusing on bars that were around during the time of the Klondike Gold Rush or the Nome Gold Rush, and trying to trace their history. And I realized at a certain point, I go, wait a second, there was this thing called Prohibition in 1918. That was 2 years before the rest of the United States. And alas, there were no bars that were serving alcohol for those almost 15 years of Prohibition. And so I thought to myself, well, I'm going to use that to my advantage. I'm going to say that that period of Prohibition reset the clock as to how old a bar can be, and that therefore, no bar can be older than April 7th, 1933, which was when beer and wine were once again legal to sell. What I found out was that the liquor licenses are very hard to find, are very scant for bars in Alaska. The National Archives are not in Anchorage anymore. Did they move already to Seattle? They had the licenses for Southeast Alaska. I found that was very valuable. The State Archives in Juneau, been there a few times. They had licenses for the 40s through the 60s. The Alaska Directory and Gazetteer for 1934 to 35 was very helpful to me. The Alaska Business Directory in 1945 was also extremely helpful. Unfortunately for me, the ABC files, the vast majority of them, only start at 1956. So not a lot of help there. But according to my 14 years of research, these are what I believe are the oldest bars in Alaska. The Imperial in Juneau, open since 1933, continuous operation since 1933. The Arctic Bar in Juneau. The Alaskan Hotel Bar in Cordova. You gotta love that sign. Can you see that from where you're sitting? The upside down sign? The story goes is that they mounted that sign upside down purpose, and so that people that found themselves waking up on the sidewalk would look, open their eyes, and know immediately where they are. This is the Panhandle Bar on 4th Avenue. It is the oldest bar in Anchorage, one of the oldest bars in the state, in case you didn't know. And the International in Fairbanks, a.k.a. the Big Eye. So I'll do a short history of alcohol in bars in Alaska. The Russians were the first to introduce alcohol to the natives of Alaska. And in particular, the Russian-American Company had a practice of offering alcohol to the natives in exchange for labor, for skins, for ivory, and sometimes sexual favors. 1867, U.S. bought Alaska from Russia, and the first prohibition began the first year, 1868. All alcohol was illegal in Alaska, but no one was paying any attention. This is from July 1st, 1869. This is the front page of the Alaska Times and Sitka. One, two, three, four. Four bars were advertising, so they were not paying attention that alcohol was illegal in Alaska. The Army was in charge of enforcing all the laws, and instead of actually enforcing laws, they got together with the natives and took a traditional beverage that the natives were making out of bark and berries, and they showed them how to distill it, ferment it and distill it, and invented a drink called Hoochinoo. Hooch, what everyone still calls, and that is Alaska's contribution to the American vernacular, the word hooch. Mind-numbing concoction. You wouldn't want to drink anything like that at all. gold discoveries in Juneau in 1880 and at the Klondike River in 1896 introduced Alaska to thousands of people. People were coming to Alaska from boats in Seattle and from San Francisco, and Congress realized in 1899 it was going to be impossible to enforce the alcohol laws in Alaska. So liquor became legal in 1899. The towns had to vote for it. You had to get voting, you had to receive, all the citizens had to approve the saloons being opened, and there were very licensed liquor sales. And this is the first license, number one. It was issued July 1st, 1900 to a Mr. Egan for his bar room in Tanana. I was unable to figure out what he called that bar, but this is license number one. Beer cost about 10 cents, and whiskey were 25 cents in the bar at that time. Women were not allowed in the saloons unless you were a prostitute or an entertainer or percentage girls. That's the woman that will encourage you to drink and usually water down beverages, and she'll get a percentage of the sale of that drink. By 1914, even before that, the temperance movement was really beginning, and the newspapers, Alaskan newspapers, were publishing stories and articles about the evils of alcohol. And they were saying that almost all of Alaska's ills and woes could be tied to the, you know, people drinking alcohol or trying to buy alcohol or trying to sell alcohol. And not a whole lot of resistance. And in 1918, like I said, a whole 2 years before the rest of the United States went dry, Alaska went dry. This was what they called the bone dry law, and the bone dry law was exactly as it sounded. Everything that had any alcohol in it at all was not allowed, including medicines. And the doctors really were upset about this because to treat influenza, the medicine at the time had alcohol in it, and they couldn't get it. They could not use it. But Alaskans were never really without alcohol. The proximity of Alaska to Canada and the isolation of Alaska, and a general apathy of Alaskans towards prohibition, made it extremely lucrative to do moonshining activities and bootlegging. There were just fleets of boats from British Columbia bringing booze into Alaska, and just many, many towns became known for moonshining. Got to include a map. McCarthy, these are hotbeds, moonshine towns, hotbeds of moonshining. McCarthy, towns along the railroad, Wasilla, Chickaloon, Nanana, Fairbanks, and of course Nome. The bone dry law ended in 1933, and this was for not just Alaska, but all of the United States. On April 8th, Anheuser-Busch delivered a case of Budweiser beer to President Roosevelt, which he accepted. Alaskans were elated when Prohibition was over. And I have a quote. This was from the Anchorage Daily Times on April 8th, 1933. And they said that the end of Prohibition was equivalent almost to the delivery of the children of Israel out of the wilderness, where for years they wandered famished in a thirst. Just love that. This is a full page ad for the Alaska Daily Empire in Juneau, and this Harry Race guy who had drugstores. He was promising beer by that Friday. Harry Race was license number one for beer and wine. 1933 to 1940. Well, 1933, they weren't called bars, they were called dispensaries, and they did serve only beer and wine. It was not till the next year that liquor became legal in Alaska, but you had to wait another 5 years before you could drink your liquor in a bar. You could still drink beer and wine in the dispensary, but finally, in 1939, dispensaries were allowed to serve hard alcohol, and forever then, the word dispensary went away, they became cocktail bars. World War II changed Alaska, I think, more than the gold rushes, even more than the discovery of oil at Prudhoe Bay. The air bases and the construction of ship harbors and fortifications all over the territory, it put, I believe, the state on a course towards statehood. 1942, the road, the Alaska Highway was punched through Canada. More people were coming to the state and more bars, particularly in Anchorage and Fairbanks. January 3rd, 1959, Alaska becomes the 49th state. Oil areas of prohibition and tourism, so 1960s to the present day. 68, the first oil wells were in Prudhoe Bay. 74, construction began on the taps. More bars, 1974, key year, more bars in Anchorage and Fairbanks. 1979, we still had a problem with natives and alcohol. It had been written about during the temperance movement. It continued. And so 1979, communities were allowed to prohibit the sale and importation of alcoholic beverages. And in 1986, communities were allowed to prohibit possession of all types of alcohol. I think it was in 1995 that Barrow became the first big city to prohibit alcohol. It has since become damp. You can bring in booze for personal use in Barrow. 1970s, tourism really began to change, transform towns, in particular the southeastern towns. Cruise ships were now bringing tourists into the southeast towns, where tourists were more than willing to buy Alaska souvenirs and spend money at a real Alaska bar. However, a lot of the bars that had been around for years and years and years could not compete with the prices of real estate in towns like Ketchikan, and many of those old bars turned into jewelry stores during this time. Really unfortunate. A lot of classic, notorious bars that closed down and are just memories now. I think that the recent glut that we of these television shows set in Alaska highlights the uniqueness of the state, but also the undeniable role that alcohol and bars have in Alaska's culture. The most famous bars in Alaska. These are, in my opinion, I believe these to be the most famous bars in Alaska. The Red Dog. I have seen t-shirts in Virginia for this bar. I mean, it is a very well-known bar. If you arrive in Juneau on a cruise ship and you start walking towards Juneau, this is the first bar you will see. Thousands of people pass through those swinging doors. Earl Forsyth was living in Juneau, and he and his friend, his partner, bought the old Bailey's Bar, Bailey's Cafe and Bar, and Earl had been to New York City and been into an old-time bar that had sawdust on the floor, and all the people working there were dressed in costume. He said, this would be really cool for Juneau. That's what we're going to do. I'm going to buy Bailey's Bar and turn it into that kind of bar, which he did. And this was the very first Red Dog Saloon, you know, 162 South Franklin Street. This is the very building that the Germania Saloon was in Juneau, pre-Prohibition. And that's Earl and Ray Mansfield, his partner. And you can see they're in costume right there. And all the if you ever go to the Red Dog, there's stuff all over the walls, which is what the tradition began there. This is photo was taken in 1950. Another thing that's unique, maybe not unique, but it's the tradition of the Red Dog is that they've had piano players there from the beginning. And this lady here, Hattie Jessup, she called herself a bunch of different names, nicknames, but she was in her 80s, in the 50s and 60s, but she traveled to Juneau every summer and just knew all the old-time songs. And so they would hand out these, you know, for some people to sing along. Look at these songs, Bicycle Bill for Two, Margie, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, When Irish Eyes Are Smiling. You said a tune to her. If you said you call out a song and she didn't know it, you would get a free drink. It moved across the street in 1966, and now it became red. And eventually it moved down to its current location in 1995, I think. No, 85. There is still a lot of stuff on the bar, on the walls of the Red Dog Saloon, including this pistol. Can you see that? Oh, yeah. That was supposedly left by Wyatt Earp. He was on his way, this is 1900, and he and his wife, Josephine, were on their way to Nome to their saloon, and he checked it in with the local authorities, and before he could pick it up again, the boat was leaving, and he checked it in and never picked it up again. The marshal sold it to a private collector, and here it is today. It's possible that pistol was owned by Wyatt Earp. That's the real Wyatt Earp, and that's the real Josephine Earp. And it is true that in 1900, they owned the Dexter Saloon in Nome, Alaska. However, Josie wrote a biography, or she ghost wrote it with someone else, and they were not in Alaska in the summer of 1900, according to her biography. They were in Arizona. So accounting for inaccuracies in dates, it is possible that the pistol did belong to Wyatt. Rosie's Bar and Grill in Pelican. Rosie Miller ended up in Pelican. She had a tugboat that was disabled, and she was towed there and fell in love with the town and decided to open a bar here. This was formerly the Lizianski Bar that had been there since the late 30s, also called Soul's Bar. I really enjoyed reading Rosie Miller. There I am interviewing her. God, she seems so blurry. Can you see that? That's me and her. She said, here's a quote for her. "My customers are what makes this bar famous. They're the ones running around without their clothes on. They're the ones dancing in the bar. Thousands of people have danced on my bar. If people don't like it, they shouldn't come in here." She told me a story. She said that a very hardcore Christian woman came into the bar one day and held her hands, and together they prayed for her soul, for all the sins that have occurred in her bar. And then this same woman bought two T-shirts with the slogan of the bar on back. I don't know why people take off their clothes in this bar, but it seems to be. It didn't happen when I was there, at least not completely. So there are. It is a fun place, and I recall. I was there the weekend of Memorial Day in 2008, and I was eavesdropping on a young woman having a phone conversation on the ferry ride back to Juneau. And she was saying, "If I wondered if I was going to hell before now," she said, "last night sealed the deal." I wrote that down. So you can see that the ceiling is just covered with signatures. And so naturally, I wanted to sign the ceiling too. But what happens is that when you're signing the ceiling, all of a sudden a bartender, woman bartender in my case, comes over while I'm standing up there on the ladder and pulls down my pants and writes Rosie's Bar on my butt cheek.
Is that in the book?
The picture? No color pictures, unfortunately. This is Chukku Charlie's in Anchorage. And this gentleman here, Mike Gordon, graduated from Anchorage High School in 1960. And he and his partner borrowed $10,000 from his wife's mother to get this started. He wanted to do a rustic Alaska-style saloon. And he definitely did. This is the most profitable bar in Alaska, bar none. It makes millions of dollars. You know, way more than the Red Dog, way more than the Bush Company, or any other bar you're thinking of. This is the most profitable bar in Alaska. It's named after a character, Chukku Charlie, a gentleman named Reuben Gaines, who was a radio personality in Ketchikan, and wrote poetry, and that's what this whole book is, a story poem about this guy, Chukku Charlie. That is not the character that you see when you go to the bar today. It's a whole different drawing of who Chukku Charlie is. But this is where this comes from. And Mike asked Reuben, "Can I use this for the name of my bar?" And he had no problem with it. So that's where that comes from. It is the biggest bar in Anchorage. It started out in this building here on the right and just expanded to the left. When you actually go in the bar, it's like 9, 10, sometimes 11 bars inside of this one place. All different kinds of music, all different kinds of things. And there have just been many, many bands that have played there. In the time that I lived here, I didn't see all these bands, but I knew they were here. They played here. This is before they played the Sullivan Arena. Metallica, Steve Miller Band, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Blues Traveler, Bon Jovi, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Ozzy Osbourne, The Beach Boys, Aerosmith, Van Halen. Chuku Charlie's has been on ESPN, on Good Morning America, David Letterman, Johnny Carson. In 2000, Playboy voted it the number one bar in the United States. I have spent more time and money in Chuku Charlie's than any other bar in Alaska. Here's an ad from the Milepost from 1973. Mike tried to open other Chuku Charlie's in Fairbanks and in Esther and in Girdwood, and they all management problems or whatever. They did not work out. So the one that we have there in Spinard on the Miracle Mile, they used to call it the Miracle Mile, is still the one and only Chukuts that we have today. One of the things I really like about Chukuts is they have a replica of the original birdhouse inside that was birdhouse burned in 1996, burned down in 1996. And in 2002, they had a replica built inside of Chukuts. And I don't know if they had the blueprints or whatever, but it is spot on. Tell me if you don't think so. I was amazed. I was like, wow, it doesn't have the smell, of course, you know, but it was, I thought it was pretty darn accurate. I think they did a really good job. And I enjoy it every time I go in. When I go to Coots, I make a beeline to the birdhouse. You can sort of see that's me. Oh, man, I'm bummed out. The salty dog in Homer. And that was established in 1957. It was Chuck and Phyllis Abbott. And that was their... what's that kind of vehicle they have? This picture is one of those, I'm trying to name it, starts with an A, where you can drive it on land. It also goes drive it off into the sea. Amphibious, that's it. Yeah, amphibious vehicle. They loved pirates. And so that was the whole theme of the original Salty Dog, was pirates. They wanted to glorify the pirates, the pirate theme, the original Salty Dogs, as Chuck called it. And so for years, that was the theme of the bar. This was a 1962 sketch of the Salty Dog. It was just one building. And 2 years later, the earthquake happened. The whole spit sank, and they had to move the bar back. But this is one of the original buildings. This one is from 1897. But now there are three small log cabins that make up the Salty Dog. And, of course, the lighthouse. You know, that you can see there in the background, which is actually shows up on the nautical charts. It's a DAWG dog, and they got the coordinates for it and everything. It is a legitimate NOAA Mariner's landmark. I was in the Salty Dog one time with my parents, and they had never been to Homer before. And this man came over to me, and he, hey, so good to see you again. He said, don't you remember me, man? We used to fish out of English Bay. And I said, no, man, I'm sorry. I don't remember you. No, and this guy was insistent. He would not let it go. You know, 5, 10 minutes, he'd go, oh, don't you remember that? He's on and on. And my dad was leaning over me. He goes, do you know this guy? I go, no, I don't. You know, but eventually I gave up. And I go, oh, yeah, now I remember. And my dad laughed for a solid minute. He was never going to stop laughing. But this is another one of those bars where you walk in and it's just kind of like the birdhouse, just, you know, all kinds of stuff on the walls. Business cards, dollar bills, bras, panties, even a human skull. They got a human skull on the wall. The Board of Trade in Nome. And that has been around since 1900. It has been destroyed by fire 3 times. It has been almost destroyed 6 times by storms. It has always been on Front Street. Here is the time when it was destroyed in 1913. That's it on the left. I guess there was also a Lacey Saloon Street, but it is, it's always been on Front Street. During the during Prohibition, they continued to operate the saloon. It was just selling soft drinks, and it operated as a card room and as a pool hall. And back when they got their liquor license back in 1934 and started serving beer and wine. And during the 40s, these gentlemen, Arvo Sario and Joe Ballbridge, really improved on it. And this was the motto of the bar during the 40s: good things for he that is dry. Jim West bought it in 1964. And he was a character, and he owned all kinds of property in Nome, and he proceeded to expand the Board of Trade Saloon. He bought buildings on either side of the bar, made it very, very large. It has a seating capacity of 125. He also put all kinds of Nome stuff all over the walls and brought in all the old Nome Nugget newspapers for people just to read. They want to come in and read the old newspapers, you go to the Board of Trade Saloon. And more bigger variety of newspapers than the library had. There's Jim West right there with his trophy for something. And it's from the Guide to Alaska in 1970. And they had a big, big party when he passed away that they still were talking about when I visited, finally visited Nome. There are five bars in town that I write about, and the old Safety Roadhouse that I also write about. The Nome BOT, as people call it, is the Board of Trade BOT is, like I said, where everyone ends up at the end of the evening. If people are going to the other bars, the whole town ends up at the Board of Trade in the evening, at the end of the night.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Doug Vandegraft, who's taking listeners on a tour of Alaska's most notorious bars. Vandegraft's new book, A Guide to the Notorious Bars of Alaska, hit the bookshelves October 1st. He spoke at the UAA campus bookstore on September 26th. From here, the talk moves into a question and answer period with the audience.
At this point, I can continue. I can keep talking about, I can go into the Seward bars, or I can just say thank you very much. So I'll leave it up to you. I could stop right there and we can just go into questions, or I could talk about Seward bars.
One gentleman comments that some of his oldest friends in Alaska, Gertrude and Harold Potter, had owned a bar 5 miles outside Seward. It was in an old log cabin, and the couple practically raised their son there. He guessed that the bar had opened in the 40s.
I have not heard of that bar, I'll be absolutely honest. Long time. There is a whole part of my book that there just wasn't room for. For after every region of Alaska, I had pages and pages of gone but forever notorious is what I call it. All the bars that people still talk about and still remember, and I listed them all, and there just wasn't room in the book for it. So all those are going to be on my website. I have a listing of them there and approximate dates and addresses and everything. And as my schedule permits, I am going to be putting ads, photos, all the stuff that I have back home. I'll just upload that for people to look at, for all the bars that I, if they were still around, they would definitely be in the book.
One gentleman from the audience says he moved to Alaska in 1966, just after the earthquake. His favorite bar at the time was called the Alley Cat.
Found lots of ads for that. Yeah, I think it was, I'm trying to remember the period of time, it was obviously the 60s, but by the time I got here in 83, it wasn't around anymore.
That same gentleman as before hops up to the microphone to share a little more about some of his favorite Anchorage bars.
Yeah, there was some great black nightclubs here when I came, one of which was the Brief Encounter, and that's the one on 15th. Right near the Alaska Aces office. Used to be a bank there. And then the other one was, it was right down on 4th Avenue. I'm blanking on the name. The Kit. Yeah, the Kit. Oh, so yeah, it was out of town. Yeah. But I remember the guys that ran it. I'm blanking on the name, but the point I was going to make was in those days, the planes, when people came flying to, let's say, going elsewhere, all the planes stopped in Anchorage for gassing up, and the people spent the night. They had Muddy Waters, B.B. King, all the big names, Little Milton. Well, when they come to the hotel, okay, they would book themselves in the, they would come to the bars, yeah? And for $4 or $5, you know, you could go in and go into those bars for $5 to see the biggest name in blues and stuff. Because they couldn't go to where they were going anyway. And it was a chance for them to make a little money and see the town, and a chance for us locals to see them, you know. And they were so, gracious with their time and everything, and approachable, and it was just fantastic. Just a good time to be here.
Doug Vandegraff hops back on the microphone here. We're still talking about the 4th Avenue bars in downtown Anchorage.
I've seen so many old photos of 4th Avenue, you know, when it was just neon. It's just bar after bar after bar, just a row of neon. The comedians would come into, they would call it the longest bar in the world, you know.
Someone from the audience asks what people were drinking back then.
You know, it was all imported. All beer, all liquor was imported. I won't go into it right now, because I was just looking into, you know, I wasn't so much what they were drinking, but how much they were drinking was what was interesting to me. You know, all kinds, everything. Yeah, and it was all imported. In the amount of money that people, Alaska Sportsman did a study in the 1950s. They said it was a staggering 17 gallons per every man, woman, child, and infant.
There's a follow-up comment tossed out there that things changed when the pipeline came to town.
I missed all of that. You know, when I got here, it was all pipeline, you know, and just all the, you know, the very first bar that I went into was the Monkey Wharf. That's the very bar number one. And I saw the monkeys in the aquarium and everything. And I didn't put this in the book. I'll share it with you people. I was just in shock at what the behavior of people in that bar. Is that what I think it is? Are they doing what I think they are doing? My wife, my fiance at the time, was like, don't stop staring, you know.
Someone asks how Doug differentiated between bars and restaurants.
Good question. I think I know what you're going to ask, you know, and I do make that distinction, is that I was trying to focus on bars. And, you know, some bars that are in there, like the Waterfront, which is now called AJ's in Homer. You know, that's a nice place to go eat. But it's been a bar/restaurant for almost its entire career. I have not included establishments that are primarily restaurants. If you can make reservations there, if you walk in the door and they're asking how many and everything like that, it's not in my book. And I know that's people are going to wonder, why isn't the Hangar in there in Juneau, or the Peanut Farm in Anchorage, or Ivory Jack's in Fairbanks? I didn't include them. They're more restaurant than they are bar.
A woman from the audience hops up to ask about a Spinard bar she remembers being called the Fancy Moose.
Thank you. I grew up real close to Spinard Lake, and so it seemed like every other incident in town was Fancy Moose, Fancy Moose, Fancy Moose. And so maybe help me reconstruct this a minute. It seemed like it was some sort of a hotel, and then it became Fancy Moose. Somebody died there every week. And then did it move? Or is that there's still a component called Fancy Moose there, and I think that's a homage to the old one.
A couple of people try to jump in here and remember the various names of the bar the first woman was inquiring about.
So I can add to that a little bit.
Good.
My first husband managed the Fly By Night in the early 80s. Prior to that, Phil Degnan managed the Holiday Inn, which is no longer downtown. He was hired away from the Holiday Inn by the owners of the, they called it the Fly By Night Club, and they had a Spanish restaurant there too. And he worked for them for about 3 years, and then they sold the property to, I believe it became the Millennium, and now it's the Clarion. So that's the story behind that particular one. It had about, they advertised it. It had 6 or 8 different names right there on the shore. And then, of course, Mr. White Keys played at the Fly By Night. I was listening to him in the late 70s, early 80s, and he ended up over on Spinard Road.
Doug Vandegraaff chips in here. Mr. White Keys, he says, got a start at Chilkoot Charlie's, where he was a piano player in a band called the Rinky Dinks.
He's the one that coined the phrase, we cheat the other guy and pass savings on to you. That's White Keys. That's White Keys. He came up with that.
A woman asks if Vandegraaff ran into cases where people were getting their mail at bars and sort of using them as de facto residences.
You know, what? One thing I did talk about, There are several bars that double as community centers, and the one in Manly Hot Springs has been used as a church sometimes. So it's like, you know, yeah. I mean, just because you go to a bar doesn't mean you don't go to church, right? So.
And there's a follow-up question. Were a lot of these bars open 24 hours?
You know, I don't think so. There's always a closing time. Yeah, there's always at least even for 1 hour. Like when I moved here, they closed bars in Anchorage closed at 5 a.m. and opened up again at 6.
From here, the conversation turns to the municipality's ban on happy hour, and then someone brings up the Red Dog Saloon in Juneau. Doug says it's one of his favorite places.
Have you guys been to that bar lately? I mean, the Red Dog Saloon. The Junoites don't like to go there. They consider it a tourist bar. But it is a crack-up. I love going that UI because they still have the piano players. And I think this is funny. There's one guy in there. He calls himself Phineas. So he'll tell the whole audience. He'll go, the next person that comes in here, I'm gonna say, look who's here, and I want everybody just to scream and yell like you can't believe they're here. And so, this couple came in the door and. We look who's here, and everybody just goes nuts for, you know, 30 seconds. These people just turned and left, you know, couldn't take it. I think it's funny. Should I keep going? You want to hear more? All right, more? Okay. So Tony Parek came from Austria. He was a World War I vet, and he came to Seward in 1922 and started in several businesses. And including the Seward Bar, Beer Bar, that was in 1933. But by 1945, he had expanded his businesses to include the Spokane Rooms and Apartments, the Portland Rooms, the Belmont Rooms, the Spokane Bar, and the Seward Bar. Now, the Spokane Bar was downstairs of the Spokane Rooms and Apartments. And so many people just started calling that bar Tony's Bar. And that's how it became named as Tony until 1945. When they formally named it Tony's Bar. Tony was a celebrity in Seward. People loved him. He had a habit of saying good morning to you, no matter what time of day it was. That was his thing. But they, again, this was a half-page ad in the Seward Polaris saying that he'll be back in town. Please come see him, and we're giving out ham sandwiches. Here's a picture I found of Tony. Inside Tony's Bar, and when he died in December 30th of 1947, it made front page news in the Seward newspaper. Here's another sketch. This is again prior to the earthquake, and so that was the Spokane Rooms. But this is still the location of Tony's Bar, still there on the concrete building there on Fourth Street. After Tony died, Sam Romack, his nephew, who came to Seward in 1922, he took over, lost a leg to diabetes, but continued to run Tony's Bar. I am impressed by bars such as Tony's that have you know, have retained the original name this long. No one remembers Tony Park, you know, but bars like this who are still, that's that original name has stood the test of time. Thorns Showcase Lounge. And this was originally Gill's Cocktail Lounge in the 50s and 60s. Gene Thorne was the manager of Gill's Lounge. And in 1971, there was a big fire, and Gene and his wife decided to buy it and refurbish it and remake it into their own, and that's when it became Thorne's Showcase Lounge. This is still impressive to me that a bar, they will hang on to lights, you know, decorations like this for so long. The neon type feel. And the throwback doesn't end here. When you go inside, I mean, this is, you know, God, the color is just completely washed out. I mean, it's dark. Everything is red. The stools are like a swivel and everything. That's probably the largest collection of Jim Beam decanters in Alaska, you know. But I feel like in the Rat Pack era of Las Vegas, when every time I go in there. The great food, though, they serve like halibut bowls and hamburgers. Great. I'd love to go in there and have something to eat. Great, great. I really enjoy Thorns. Here's the Yukon. And there's another picture of Mount Marathon in the back. The lot on which the Yukon Bar sits is the original site of the D.C. Brownell Hardware Store. And that was in 1903. It was the very first lot sold in the new railroad town of Seward. $1,000 for that lot. The hardware store burned down and was never rebuilt. Mr. Brownell died, and it became a variety of uses. But by 1945, it was a bar, a Novick's Cocktail Bar. And Vance Hitt, who was another kind of guy in town who had lots of business interests, he also owned a bar in Nanana. He apparently had a Vance's bar, the 5 Mile Roadhouse. Well, the Novick's decided to move in 1949, and they sold the bar to Vance and Amy Hitt. And Bill and his wife moved to Michigan and opened another bar, and within 6 months he had a heart attack and died. Really, really unfortunate. Yeah. So the Hitts bought the bar, Novick's Cocktail Bar, and renamed it the Yukon. And it is the bar that is most associated with the Mount Marathon race. The race begins adjacent to it, and it ends like right about in front of it. And there are a lot of people, again, when they think of the Mount Marathon bar the race, or they think of the Yukon bar, they're thinking about Mount Marathon. Hobo Jim has played here countless times. He is a frequent entertainer at the Yukon bar. And it's a nice looking bar. I'm doing a book signing there next Thursday night after my presentation at the Alaska Historical Society Conference. And apparently its toilet is also unique. There is a blog out there called Toilets of the World, and this is the only toilet in a bar in Alaska that's so featured with its honor. The Pit. This is outside of town, and right up there, right near the city limit. And it's been there since 1955. Irwin Corbin, who was a World War II vet, he had previously owned the Surf Bar in Seward. And decided to got a Quonset hut originally and opened up the Pit. And in 1965, a man came into the bar and shot him twice in the back of the head and grabbed $200 out of the till and fled. Irwin was alone at the time, and the phone rang, and he was able to crawl to the phone and call for help. Irwin survived and owned the bar for a whole another 10 years. As far as I could tell, they never did find the guy who shot him. But this is one tough SOB. He took the bullets out of his brain and everything. The pit has gone through a succession of owners, very, very nice people. But I remember it was the couple that both died really, really young. Very congenial couple. I'm trying, their name eludes me at the moment. Hard to keep track. I wrote about the 135 bars. I'm trying to remember the names of people. One of my most memorable memories of being at the pit was I was there in 96 with some friends from the lower 48, and we had just been out halibut fishing on Resurrection Bay. And as we were leaving, we encountered a situation where one man was at odds with several other men. And I intervened, and I said that the cornered man was with us, and he's leaving with us, which he did. And he was really grateful at first until we put him in the back seat, seated between people who had been at the pit for about 3 hours. And he asked to be let out as soon as we got into Seward. That's it. Are there any other questions?
Someone asks Doug if his new book is more of a guidebook or a history book.
You bet. All of that. It's definitely a guidebook. I want you to understand, how and why the bar came to being, anything that is significant has happened in there, and what it's like to visit it today. You bet. One of the best parts about this whole project was finding all the old ads, and I picked some of the best, and they're in the book. You saw all those sketches. That was just a gold mine when I found that. This woman who just sketched bars all over Alaska in the early 60s, Connie Silver, and called the publishing company, and they never heard of her. So I was going to try to get permission to use her, and so I don't know who she was, but she drew bars up and down the Seward Highway, all the way to Fairbanks, to Seward, to Homer, and fortunate for me. I hope it was a pleasure here being today. It's nice to talk to people that are so as interested in this as much as I am.
And that about wraps it up. You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Doug Vandegraaff. His new book, A Guide to the Notorious Bars of Alaska, hit the bookshelves October 1st. For more information on the book, you can find a link to it on our website at alaskapublic.org. This talk was recorded by the University of Alaska at the UAA Bookstore September 26th. For more podcasts from UAA events, you can check out the iTunes Store by searching for UAA Campus Bookstore. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. I'm your host and producer, Monica Goki.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.